It is both an honor and a pleasure to be with all of you this afternoon. I'm also a guest here, but I'm very happy to be in your midst and to be able to share with you some of my experiences and realizations on the path of yoga. As you probably know, there's different schools of yoga, different types of yogis in India, hatha, jnana, raja, bhakti, but they're all compared to steps on a ladder to attain a higher destination, to attain the supreme, as you could say. And our particular school of yoga, our way of walking up the ladder, is primarily through mantra meditation, through chanting devotional songs which help elevate our consciousness. Different types of sounds affect us in different ways. For example, if you're listening to the radio, you're just turning the dial and you come across a happy song. And just see how it affects you. You may be down, but you hear some... I don't listen to the radio, I don't even have an iPod, but... You know, you listen to something, some band has a really nice song, and you listen to it and you feel happy. And you turn the sound, the dial a little bit further, and then you come to someone singing the blues. If you listen for a long time, you also get down. She left me and I'm all alone. Oh, yeah, she left me too. And then you go a little further and you hear, you know, something about President Bush, you know, the surge, the increase of the troops and the war. Hey, I don't like that idea. I'm getting a little angry. In just a matter of 5 minutes, you've experienced so many different states of consciousness. Happy, sad, and mad. So therefore, the ancient Vedic scriptures of India, they say that sound is very potent. It can condition us, and vice versa, it can liberate us. Just like a magnet. A magnet has two very powerful potencies. It can attract, and it can repulse. So sound can help to condition us in this world, make us feel part of this world. Or if we come in contact with the right sound, it can liberate us from this world. Because according to the ancient teachings of India, which we find in books like Bhagavad Gita, paras tasmatu bhavanyo vyakto vyakta shanatana. This is of course Sanskrit. Beyond this world, which is sometimes manifest and sometimes unmanifest, there's another world which is never annihilated. It's described as eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. And that's actually the destination of any transcendentalist, any yogi. Whether he feels comfortable with the hatha process, or he feels comfortable with the jnana, or he feels comfortable with the raj, or he feels comfortable with the bhakti, different strokes for different folks. But ultimately, every transcendentalist, the purpose of the yoga ultimately is to get out of the cycle, the repeated cycle of birth and death. It's not just to become healthy. That's like a side benefit. It's definitely there, because you have to be healthy, live a long time in order to become self-realized. So here in the States, I've been traveling, I've noticed that most people are yoga practitioners because of the benefits that come from health and equilibrium of mind and peace. But that's like the first stage, the first rung in the ladder. The yogi would do the asanas, he would become very peaceful. And then, when there's no agitation in the mind is peaceful, and this world is stress and anxiety and politics and war and diplomacy, what would he do? He would go deep within and discover his spiritual nature. So this sound is very helpful. any yoga practitioner, regardless of whatever school he's practicing, this mantra meditation is very helpful. You may have experienced that when you're practicing yoga, that and you're sitting for some time in the asanas, and the mind is coming peaceful, then some thought or some desire comes which distracts you. You've got to put in your tax statement by April 15th, you know, and think, oh my God, what am I going to do? Or the phone rings, you jump up, hello! You know, you're sitting, you're doing your asanas, and everything, then some, just like bubbles I've seen in, sometimes in the lake, you're sitting in a very peaceful lake, and you see these bubbles come up from the bottom of the, from the mud, bubbles come up like that. So you're very peaceful, and some thoughts come and disturb you and distract you from your meditation on something higher than just ordinary life. So how to deal with that? How to control the mind so that we can go within and discover our deeper spiritual nature? This process may be very helpful to you, this chanting which we do. Actually, in Sanskrit, mantra means ma means mind, and tra means to deliver. So a mantra is a sound, not a sound that makes you materially happy or a sound that makes you blue, sad, or the sound that gets you angry. It's a sound that goes deep within and unlocks the energy of the soul. And even if you're meditating, if you're doing mantra meditation, the sound is so powerful that your mind won't get carried away. So you can try it in your hatha yoga. When you're sitting there in the asana and you're very peaceful and some disturbance come, you can do some mantra meditation. So I'd like to start the program this afternoon with some mantra meditation. So many mantras. But it's described in the Brihad Narayan Purana. Hariya Nam, Hariya Nam, Hariya Nam, Eva Kevalam, Kuloa Nashdeva, 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 Gatiranyathad. That particularly in the age in which we live, this mantra, this which we're famous for singing, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. It's called Maha Mantra. It's the great chant for delivering the mind from material thoughts. So we'll start off. It's always good when you start these programs to create a very auspicious atmosphere, surcharged with divine energy. And then we'll have a short discussion after that more about yoga. But in this sanctified atmosphere, this spiritual atmosphere, you can hear better, understand better. So when we do this mantra meditation, we do it through the means of kirtan. You can do it in two ways. You can chant these divine sounds on meditation beads. This is called japa. Or you can chant it out loud. So because we're so many people, we'll chant out loud. And what I'd like to do, I'll teach you the mantra, and then I'll sing it with musical instruments. It just, you know, it makes captures the attention better. So what I'd like you to do is sit in a very comfortable position. Most of you, I assume, are somewhat accomplished in the practice of yoga, hatha yoga. So you sit in whatever position is most comfortable for you. And I'd like you to close your eyes and just take a deep breath, hold it for a minute, and let it out. And again, a deep breath, hold it, and let it out. One more time. Very deep breath. Hold it, and then let it out. That helps to still the body so the mind can be peaceful. And now you try to clear your mind of all thoughts. That's difficult, but just kind of forget whatever happened this morning and forget what's happening this afternoon or even tomorrow. Any of those things that might disturb you from this special moment that we're having together this afternoon, just free the mind from all thoughts and then just focus on the transcendental sound vibration. This is a vibration which is not created in this world. This is a vibration which comes from a divine realm. And if one is receptive, one can perceive the special nature of that vibration. So you will say the mantra two words at a time, and you just say it and just try to focus on the sound, nothing else, and repeat after me. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Okay, we'll try it again. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Okay, so now relax a little bit to your normal sitting position. Open your eyes. So that's a mantra. And you'll experience by chanting mantra that it's very attractive. In fact, because it's a divine sound and it touches the soul, so to speak, it kind of like wakes the soul up. Like the great yogis, they say, we're all sleeping in this world. Hey, I'm not sleeping, I'm working, I'm, you know, playing football. Sleeping in the sense that we're unaware of our higher spiritual state. So when you chant a mantra, it's like, whoa, you wake up. And you understand your deeper spiritual nature. You understand the Supreme. It's kind of like an alarm clock. Ding, ling, ling, and you wake up. Whoa. So this will help to wake us up spiritually. The other day one boy said, you know, just this mantra over and over and over and over. I said, yes, you can do it because it's something transcendental. So we'll chant now. I'll be using this, this is called a harmonium. It's actually not really an Indian instrument. It was introduced by the French in Pondicherry about 300 years ago in India. Because the typical Indian instruments like a sitar or tambour or tabla. So this is not really, this is French. Voilà, c'est très bon, monsieur, c'est français. Mais, you know, they've utilized it. Now it's become very much part of Indian culture. It works on a reed system. There's reeds here, and like a bellows. And Gaurai here is going to play a drum. This is called mridanga. It's a two-headed drum. And some of the members, they have little symbols, kartals like this. So it's not really essential because the divine sound itself is enough to wake the soul up to who he really is. But it helps to keep us focused. And it adds kind of a melodious nature, a joyful nature to the meditation. So I'll lead this type of mantra meditation. One person sings and the other persons respond. So I'll chant. And then what we do in the very beginning, we offer some glorification to our guru. The guru is one who gives this knowledge and this process to the student or the disciple. So the disciple is very grateful to be able to make some progress in transcendence by the mercy of the guru. So before you start any spiritual function, you offer respects to your guru. So we'll chant some prayers to the guru. And then after 1 or 2 minutes, we'll be singing Hare Krishna, that mantra. So when I sing it, you respond. And we'll see how much progress you make. Because one symptom of progress is that the soul becomes liberated, and in your liberated state, you're very happy. You smile, you dance. You know, let's see. Hare Krishna. Bhakti Yoga. It's a nice way to become self-realized. I'm going to give a little talk here about yoga. I'm going to leave time for questions, if you have any questions. And then we'll chant again. The chanting is the best part. I'm going to read from the Bhagavad Gita. It's the handbook of the science of self-realization in India. One wouldn't really want to begin practicing yoga without having a good grasp of the Bhagavad Gita. Just like when you buy a computer, you buy a Mac. It comes along with a handbook. And it always says on the package, be sure to read the handbook before you use the product. It makes sense. Once you start fooling around with it, you know, you may misuse it, you may abuse it, but you certainly won't get the most out of it unless you first read the handbook. So what is the handbook for yoga? What is the handbook for the yogis? It's Bhagavad Gita. Because all the systems of yoga are described in Bhagavad Gita. So all the yogis, without exception, they read this book. All great spiritual persons in India, they refer to this book. Like you know Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. He's a famous figure, spiritual figure and political figure in the history of India. So he was for nonviolence, ahimsa, peace, you know, brotherhood, sisterhood, like that. And if you look at a picture of him, he's always carrying a book in his hand, Gandhi. This is the book he was carrying, Bhagavad Gita. It contains all the ground rules for yoga. So a yogi actually wouldn't just, you know, spontaneously go to the forest and sit. No, it's a science. And like any science, it has to be based on some authority. So the authority is the Bhagavad Gita. But it's very, very deep. Very profound, full of so many gems of self-realization. And to really understand it, you also need a teacher. So you go to school, I want to learn mathematics. You don't start speculating, I think math, you go to school. But how do you learn the subject when you're in school? How do you learn the handbook? You have a teacher, you have your math teacher, or your history teacher, or your language teacher, like that. I remember when I first started playing guitar, you can see I have a little musical ability. I was, you know, too expensive. I was just a kid in San Francisco, California, 1960. So, you know, music and all that kind of stuff was part of our culture. So I bought a guitar, you know. And I didn't have enough money to take any lessons, so I was like every day, you know, trying to figure out. I got the A down, I got the D down, the G. Couldn't figure out the C, the E, E minor, A minor, F sharp. So one day my mother said, hey, look, I'm sick and tired of all this noise in the house. Bing, wong, wong. So I'm going to pay for you to go to a teacher. So I went to the teacher, and like in 1 week, I'd learned more than I'd been practicing for 6 months. So along with the book, you also need the teacher. So this is the book. Who's the teacher? Well, the book indicates the teacher. It says, Tadviri paripatena pariprasena sevaya upadekshanti tegyanam gyaninash tatvat darshana. It's a very beautiful language sense, but it's almost like pure poetry. Just try to learn the truth, spiritual truth, by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively, render service to him. The self-realized souls can give you knowledge because they've seen the truth. So if you have these two things, this ancient text, over 5,000 years old, 700 verses, little pearls of wisdom, and you have a self-realized teacher who can teach you the mysteries of this book and how to put it into practice, then you can become a perfected yogi. Whether you're a hatha, raja, jnana, or bhakti yogi. So we're fortunate we have this book here. And the amazing thing is that up until recently, it was only in Sanskrit. So the real secrets of the East were not available for us. Many people they have an inclination towards the East because they can't find all the answers to their questions about spiritual life in the West. You're like, where do you go? The deeper, like, what is the soul? What happens at the moment of death? Is there an absolute truth? You know, these things are briefly described, but in India, whoa, there's volumes and volumes of literature as you can discover these things. So our teacher, Srila Prabhupada, the founder of our movement, he took this ancient book from Sanskrit and he translated it into English with purports. So let's just read one verse today and then just kind of talk about it a little bit, analyze it from different points of view, because yoga is also about philosophy. It's not just about the asanas and healthy diet, clean living. It's also about philosophy, trying to understand who we are. So here's a verse from the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. It's verse 24. It says, "One should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with determination and faith and not be deviated from the path. One should abandon without exception all material desires born of mental speculation and thus control all the senses and all sides by the mind." And our guru's purport: "The yoga practitioner should be very determined and should patiently prosecute the practice without deviation. One should be sure of success at the end and pursue this course with great perseverance, not becoming discouraged if there's any delay in the attainment of success." So, Prabhupada says that we have to be very determined because the process of yoga is actually, or the end goal of yoga is very difficult to attain. What is the end goal of yoga? The end goal of yoga is to realize our deeper spiritual self. And right now, we're very conditioned. We're very, very much absorbed in our bodies. When you're getting ready for school or work in the morning, you spend about 10 or 15 minutes in front of the mirror. Maybe some of you spend longer. And you're thinking, today I'm looking very beautiful. Today I have pimple, I don't want to go to school. Or the boys, they work out in the gym the day before, and they get up. If we had some, you know, video camera in the bathrooms, imagine what you would see as the boys, and they punch the mirror like a tough guy. We think we're the body. So actually the first goal in yoga, the first step in self-realization, the first point of philosophy that accompanies the asanas is to understand you're actually not the body. You're not that body. You are the spark of life within that body. That's really what yoga. Yoga means to come to the point of realizing, aham brahmasmi, I am not matter, I am spirit. Actually, when you talk about the body, what do you say to your friends? This is my hand, this is my arm, this is my chest, this is my tummy, this is... You don't say, I hand, I arm, I head. It's mine. It belongs to me. Well, who's the me? That's the point. The whole point of yoga is to do the asanas and be completely withdrawn from this world, like a tortoise brings all its limbs in the shell. You just cut off the world altogether for a few minutes every day, and you go in. That's the purpose. The health, that's great. The skinny body, that's also great. But it's not that finally I'm a yoga practitioner, you look in the mirror and there's not an ounce of fat in my body. I'm a yogi! Hello? Yes, yogis were in great shape. But great shape because it takes a long time to realize the self within. It's actually that self which gives life. It's like the sun. This universe is dark, right? It's only lit up because of the presence of the sun. The rays of the sun extend to the far corners of the universe. The sun is very tiny, infinitesimal compared to the universe, but it gives light. So conceive of your body like that dark universe, and in the body is the sun, the soul, and the soul is lighting up the whole body with consciousness. The soul, where is the soul? Here. It's a tiny particle of spirit, but very potent, like a computer chip, a Pentium computer chip. I don't know what they're up to now. But how much can you put on that Pentium? So much you can put. You can put practically the knowledge of mankind on that chip. So if that's possible for the tiny brain of a scientist, imagine how the Supreme can compact all life into a tiny spirit soul like that. And he's there. And because of the presence of the soul, the Atma, the consciousness is diffused. So when you touch your head, you feel it. When you touch your toe, you feel it. Because the soul is emanating the consciousness. It's described as 1/10,000th the tip of a hair in dimension. And it's floating on the prana, which is air, the life air, subtle air, it's there. And when you identify yourself, you say to someone, I, you point your chip, I want to tell you. You don't say, I want to tell you. Well, you point here, because intuitively we feel life is here in the heart. It's not a material thing. The body doesn't have life. It's made of skin and bones and blood and mucus and hairs and stuff like that. It doesn't have life. Matter is not alive. It's dead. What's the body made? Same thing that makes up this harmonium, but it's more water. In medical school, I learned that 70% of the body is water, like a big drop. So you're not water and, you know, skin and hairs. You're just like a driver in a car. There's a car, there's a guy inside driving it. So sometimes, especially boys, they become so attached to their car, you know, that if you like help them polish it, you know, wow, I'm looking good, my car. And if you bang that car, oh, ow, oh, I didn't hit you, I hit your car. Yeah, but ow, ow, my car, oh. You see? We feel pleasure and pain in this world because we identify with the body. The whole way of getting detached from suffering is to become detached from that bodily concept of life and to realize your spiritual nature. That's why yogis can do all those fantastic things like walk through fire, sit on nails, you know, meditate on the Himalayas. I was up in Muktinath. Oh, man, that place is ice. I saw yogis sitting on the ice, meditating, only in a cloth around their laps. I had my down jacket, you know, my muff, my jacket, my earmuffs, my huge boots, and there are these guys sitting with nothing on the ice. And I remember walking up there, it's in Nepal, not far from Everest, actually. These are holy places that you can visit. I like to go to these distant holy places. And the first time I saw a yogi, he was walking down the road. I was going up, he was coming down. And he was walking, and I noticed he was in bare feet on the ice. I think, oh, I've got to get a picture of this. And then he stopped, and he spoke Hindi. And I know a few words in Hindi. So we were kind of having a conversation. And I looked down, as he was standing there, the ice was melting under his feet. I'm not kidding. This is not it. And by the time we finished our conversation, there was no ice left. It was the ground, the dirt. I saw with my own eyes. This is yoga. So, if you become detached from the body, you're detached from all miseries in life, like stress and anxiety and doubt and confusion and fear. Because actually we're not the body, we're the soul. So the yogi, actually what he's doing is he's looking inside. And why is he looking inside? Because that's where there's real happiness, on the spiritual platform. You're not going to find real happiness in this world of matter. You don't become a yogi so you can become better at enjoying the world, like better sex. I'm really in top shape now. No. Actually, yogis are by nature celibate. They conserve the energy that goes out, and they pull it in And they use that sex energy, that sex drive. It's a very powerful force making the whole world go around. Love makes the world go around. They draw it in and they use it for becoming self-realized. They don't mind being celibate because the realizations they get are so deep and so profound. The pleasure is much higher. So they go in because they know this world, okay, it's a world, it's sweet, it's nice, there's some nice things in this world, there's, you know, spring has sprung, and the daffodils are coming up, the trees are turning green, everyone's happy, the long, coldest winter in Toronto in 100 years is over. Oh, gosh, I'm so happy. Right? Some babies have been born, and the mothers are like, my baby, my... But you can read the newspaper, there's two sides to life. Like two sides to a coin. There's happiness, or there's heads, and there's tails. So we can't be naive. This life also means distress. And sometimes you wonder, is there more stress, distress than happiness? You have to judge for yourself where you're at. But certainly, you can't be perfectly happy here. There's always some sand in the ice cream. Even if you just have a few grains, like you're eating an ice cream cone in the summer, we'll just project a little bit, a couple months, you know. Hot day in here, Toronto. Mom, I want some ice cream. Her mantra is ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. That's her mantra. She buys the ice cream cone, and while licking it, it falls off onto the ground. So you know kids that pick it up. That's it. The few grains of sand are there. It you know, it's not exactly what you just want, a pure ice cream cone. Some grains out. So life is, even if you're Bill Gates, he's retiring. He's not just retiring with a pension from the government, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month, $1,000. He's retiring. The government needs him. He doesn't need the government at billions. So he's retiring to do charity work, which is nice. But, you know, even him, something's going to come. His money can't stop, like, getting diseased or getting old. Can't stop old age. You can do the Botox. Is that what they call it? Botox? The wrinkles away. You can dye your hair. Like, most old people, I don't even know if people have gray hair anymore. You know, they have their beautiful blondes at 82. So you can kind of, like, fake it. But old age is not the most... I'm 60. I'm like old. My knees are giving out. I have to have a... I got a hearing aid here. I took it out because the noise was too loud. Old age is not something pleasant. But you can't... You don't know until you get there, so I don't... Anyway. And then death comes. I never thought that happened to me. Happens to the best of them. So anyway, we don't want to dwell too much on the distress side because we're here to learn how to be happy. But just to kind of clue us in, the real happiness is within, on the spiritual platform. There's no hankering, there's no lamenting, there's no doubt, there's no stress, there's no anxiety. It's actually a numbness, a life of bliss. So yogis know that because they read the book and they have a teacher. So they know, they have some faith that it's really within. You have to go and learn your spiritual nature, your deeper spiritual nature. That's where the happiness is. We're looking everywhere, but the right place. I was recently in the Himalayas, at the foothills of the Himalayas, near Darjeeling, and it was the very beautiful part of the year, and it was the time when all the deer are mating. And the musk deer has this, the male deer, a secretion comes from his navel. But that's the source of the musk perfume. Now it's illegal to kill. They used to kill the deer and take those little granules and grind them down and mix them with sandalwood oil. And that's how you got musk perfume. I actually have a bottle of that perfume. One family in India, I spend a lot of time in India and I stay with different families when I travel. And that one family, old aristocratic family, they had a bottle of original musk perfume from about 1880 or something. And they gave it to me. I still have it. I actually have it back at the house. I travel because I use it for my altar. And you take one drop of that original musk and you put it on your hand like this. Oh my God. You're like faint. It's mystical. It's intoxicating. The smell is unbelievable. And you know, you take a shower, 3 days later, you can still smell it. It's so powerful. So that's why musk was so much wanted in the, you know, in the early 1900s and, you know, or long back. But to get it, you had to kill the deer. So Indian government stopped killing a deer. Now they produce it artificially. Anyway, my point is, not that I have a bottle of musk. My point is, what's this renounced monk doing with perfume? But the deer, it's used for the purpose of, amongst the deer, they use it to attract the female deer. It's kind of the other way around in human society. The girls put it on to attract the boys. But in the animal kingdom, the boys, the deer, the musky, attack the girls with this scent. But of course, he's an animal. He doesn't know what's going on. It's all kind of like just happening by nature's way. Keep the species going. So what happens, it's hilarious. I was sitting on a veranda overlooking a beautiful lake with the Himalayan mountains in the background and forests and, you know, birds. And it was just like idyllic scene for meditation, for like chanting like this or studying. And I saw a musk deer, a male deer come. And he was boing, boing, bouncing. And he had become intoxicated by that scent. And he was trying to figure out where it was. He didn't know it was in his own navel. And he's bouncing around looking for the source of that beautiful aroma. And he got intoxicated on the scent. He got confused. So he banged into a tree, boing, and he sat there. And the female deer, there's a little group of them looking like, what's this crazy guy doing? And then he went and he tripped over a rock and then he slipped in a puddle and he gets up. He's running. I started running around in circles until he got all dizzy and he fell down on the ground. And the female deer just went away. So I was trying to think, you know, like when I travel, I try to see the world through the eyes of these ancient shastras. And I was thinking, yes, we're like that. We are looking for happiness outside everywhere. We don't know that it's really within. It comes within. So the yogis know that. You don't have to go like everywhere around. Just look within you. So to do that, you have to stop contact with the world. If you're going to go within, you can't do two things at once. You've got to, some part of the day, you've got to reserve for just going within. So what yoga means, you stop asanas, like the turtle, you pull your extremities in, you pull your head in, your body, you can't really do it, but like the turtle, you pull all the extremities in the body, and then you're set for going within. Because we have to withdraw the senses sometimes in this world. We have to withdraw the senses. Because the senses are the way we become entangled in this world. Like a fly, let's say a spider, he builds a really nice web, fancy web, right? And he can walk all across, no problem, the spider. He doesn't get entangled. But it's for the fly. The fly comes, boing. He's got 1 foot hanging there in the web. So he tries to get detached. He pushes off with a second foot, and he gets then a third foot. They have 6 feet, right? Fourth, and pretty soon, he's entangled. You understand? We're like that. We have our senses, the ear, eye, the nose, the tongue, the belly, and the genital. And the way the soul within gets entangled in the web of material existence is the senses are engaged in various activities. Let's go to a movie. Let's go to a rock and roll concert. Let's go to McDonald's. You see? The soul's confused. He thinks he's the body and he wants to enjoy. So through the senses, he's like the fly. Boing, boing, boing. All the 6 legs get intact. It's hard to get out. Then the spider comes and he wraps the cocoon. He saves you for a rainy day. He'll eat you up. So we become like that. The soul's confused. I am matter. I am body. I am American, I have a French body, I'm French, I'm a German, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, I'm black, I'm white, I'm young. We'll even die for those causes. We're so confused, we're so bewildered. So what the yogi does, okay, stop. Withdraws all the senses. I'm nothing material, I'm completely spiritual. No more material engagement. Because all these material activities, they trap us. So it's like the fish, he gets caught by his tongue. The fisherman puts some bait on the hook into the water, and the fish come, yum, 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 dinner. Got caught by his tongue. You catch a deer, the hunter plays a flute. And the deer is, oh, sweet, sweet. The moth can't control his sense of sight, so he sees a beautiful fire. Oh, lovely, lovely. You could even catch an elephant. You dig a big hole, and you put a female elephant on the other side in rut, and then the male elephant comes, hello, darling, and then he falls in the hole. He's controlled by his sex desire. Really? This is yoga. Yoga means stop it all, enough of that nonsense, like the turtle. And actually the real yogis, they would spend their whole life like that. It wasn't just 15 minutes or 20 minutes a day. It was their whole life, internal. So you see the pictures of the yogis in ancient India? Actually, I saw a yogi like that in the Himalayas. I mean, of course they have to eat and stuff like that, but say 22 hours a day. Om Aham Brahmasmi. I am not matter, I am spirit. So their hair grows real long. And I am not exaggerating. I saw a yogi, his hair was from this wall to that wall. Now you may think no one's hair grows that long, but I saw it. I even have a picture of it. He was washing it in the river. It was like flowing in the river. Oh my God. And then he got out and he piled it on top of his head in this knot. And it said that all the siddhis, all the mystic powers of a yogi are in his hair. So he may be very powerful. Sometimes they may even abuse their power. Just cut his knot, the top knot off his hair, and he loses his power. Like that. So, this is the yogi. And the fingernails are like this. And they'd actually curled back around like that, and his toenails were like that as well. Thin, like a rib cage, like that. So this is like the example of the tortoise is given. Of course, we may not be able to do like that. No one's going to say, yeah, I'm a successful yogi, look how skinny, I got too skinny. What do they call that when people eat and then they regurgitate?
Anorexia.
Huh? Anorexia. They think they're looking beautiful. Look how beautiful I am. Hey, honey. You're like, too much of a good thing is not good. So yogis, they withdraw. We can't do that, but we can follow in their ancient footsteps by trying to live a more simple existence. Not being enamored by all the things in this world and have to keep up with the Joneses. You know, we can't imitate the ancients, but we can take the essence of it and really try to live a simple life. So any transcendentalist, really, his philosophy is simple living with high thinking. Doesn't have all the modern goods and all the tricks and all the, you know, the tinklies and the shinies and this and that. No. Ishavasham idam sarvam yat kinja yagatyam jagat tena tat tenu bunjitaha magridaha kashashridhanam. It's been a while since I quoted that. Everything that moves and doesn't move in this cosmic manifestation is owned and controlled by the Supreme. Therefore, one should take only what is necessary for himself, leaving the rest aside. So take what you need. And then if you do that, if you can live a simple life, like Gandhi said, the problem is not people are taking according to their need, they're taking according to their greed. And therefore you see there's not enough in the world. Although this world was created so that everyone has a quota, Because people are not spiritual, they're into the material, and they think that by satisfying those senses they'll become happy, not satisfying the Atma within, like polishing the cage of a bird and not feeding the bird inside. They think, oh, I'll be happy. But you're never happy with as much material things as you have, you'll never be happy. It's like pouring kerosene on a fire. It just goes higher and higher and higher. Like the beggar's thinking, if I just had one more dollar, I'd be happy. Bill Gates is thinking, if I had another billion, I'd be happy. You see? The yogis, they understand all these things. So he says, you know, either you renounce it altogether, or if you live in a modern world like we do, we can't, you know, go back in time. And just take your quota. Everybody needs. Some people need more, some people less. I'm a monk. I don't need very much. You may be married. You can also be a yogi. You have a husband, and you have a wife, you have children. Okay, keep it simple. Because the more you try to satisfy the senses, the more you become anxious and for more and more and more and more. And then, when's the happiness ever come? There's a nice story of one yogi. He had one cloth like this, which he used to wrap around his waist, like this. And then he decided to get a second one. So he would wear one, and he would put the other one on the branch of the tree when it was drying. So then he's thinking, like, my life has been very simple. Now I have this extra cloth. And he saw that one mouse was coming every day and eating the second cloth. He's thinking, I don't like this mouse eating my second cloth. So what I will do is I will get one cat. So he left his meditation on the banks of the Ganges and he went into town and he got a cat donated. So sure enough, the cat kept away the mouse. So he was, shanti, shanti, peaceful to do his meditation. It wasn't bothering his cloth. So then, one cat came, meow, looking at the, cat came looking at one mouse. Then, oh, the cat, yes. So then the cat's going, meow, I'm very hungry. So then he thinks, how am I going to feed this cat which is keeping the mouse away from my wrapper? So he thought, I have to get cow. So he went and he did some good Samaritan service and he got a little donation and he bought a cow. So he brought the cow home on the bank of the river. And, of course, he got the milk to feed the cat to keep the mouse away from his wrapper. But then he was thinking, I need someone to milk the cow. So I have to get a wife. So he shaved his face. And he combed his hair, which is hard because it was matted hair from 100 years. And he ate a little bit more. He was kind of anorexic from his yoga. And he put a little weight on and a little musk perfume there. And he walked into town. And lo and behold, there she was waiting for him. A match made in heaven. And he brought her home and said, milk the cow. Om. So she's milking the cow. And she says, hey, I'm not going to live under a tree. You got to get us a house. He said, okay, how do I get a house? She said, you got to get a job. The yogi said, okay, I got to get a job to get a house for my wife so she can milk the cow, so we can feed the cat to keep the rat away from my cloth. Thanks, honey. We haven't signed the papers yet for the marriage ceremony. I'm just going to throw away the cloth. I'm going to go back, grow my beard back. I was much happier with nothing. So, of course, we can't do that, but I'm just making a point here. The more simple you keep it, the less problems there are. But that's not the philosophy of modern society. We're kind of caught in this, like, you get caught up and you fall into a river and you're caught in the current like everybody else. We're kind of caught in this current that the more you have, the more happier you'll be. But if you're happy within, you can be happy with the basic necessities. If you don't have that internal joy, if you don't have that internal realization, you're not going to be happy living a simple life. There's lots of people who have a simple life, they're not happy. But if you have that inner realization, you can do it. Now, it does take time. So this verse said you have to be patient. These realizations don't come very quickly. So you have to be very determined. Very determined to keep it simple. Very determined to give yourself that time every day for your meditation. You're going within. You have to give yourself that time. But it's a worthwhile investment. Because all the other time spent in this world, the returns are temporary. And when you die, everything's taken away. But this investment in meditation, in yoga, healthy living, philosophy, like that, they call it alternative living now. Well, it should be the way of life. The investment in the Gita, Krishna says that whatever advancement you've made spiritually, when you die, the credit goes with you to your next life. Because the life's like a book, and there's different chapters. There's this birth, and then there's next birth. You know, reincarnation. It's not just a philosophical thing. Reincarnation is just a law of nature. They say, oh, this philosophy from India. Excuse me, sir. Reincarnation is just like as real, as material as the sun rising and setting, or the moon rising and setting, or the patterns of the tides in the ocean, or whatever. Dehi nosmin yata dehe kovanam yovanam jara tatate antaras paptir diras tata namuyanti. As the embodied Atma soul, goes from infancy to youth to manhood to old age, the soul enters into another body at death. Death is not the finish. Death is a new beginning. For one who has taken birth, death is certain. For one who has died, birth is certain. So if you could look at the bigger picture, the bird's eye, the eagle view, eagle's eye of your life, you would see that you've been a king, you've been a queen, you've been rich, you've been poor, you've been American, Australian, Chinese, you've been a man, you've been a woman, nowadays something in between. You've been everything. You've been there and done that. You've been there and you've done that. Life is a succession of different chapters, different bodies. So, again, you have to invest, because if you invest in this way of life, if you take your chosen path and you do it with determination, then the credit carries over with you. You lose your house, you lose your husband, you lose your kids. I mean, sorry, just taking the truth. Sadhu means one who speaks the truth. It may not always be palatable, but like the doctor has to speak the truth. So then you lose it all. You can't even take one penny with you when you die. But whatever advancement you've made, it stays with you. And your next lifetime, you're born with that illumination. Like it said in the scriptures, that people who are very elevated spiritually, they generally take birth in India. And people who are very like I'm sharp and clever and passionate, they'll take birth like in America, Canada, or these countries. Because you see the propensity here, you know, Western people are much more expert at like material progress than the East. The East is for more like for self-realization, and the West is more for material progress. So you take your birth according to your level. And I see often, like when I travel in India, I see little kids. I said, you talk to them. And they're way beyond this introductory talk. They're 7 years old. I have to talk to them like, I talk about the 17th chapter of this book, 18th chapter. Anyway. So it takes time. And some of you may actually be on your third or fourth birth of self-realization. This may not be your first time. Therefore, you're attracted to come to the program. Huge city here, millions of people. Where are they all? And they don't have that interest. But you have kind of like a spontaneous interest. You're spiritual seekers because you're well on the road, on the path of self-realization. And one day you will realize the self within, if you're determined. You know what? When you see the self within, you'll also see the self within in others. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmani gavihastini suni chaiva sapakicha pandita samadarshanaha. You know, becoming self-realized, you don't realize yourself, but you realize your lover. You don't realize just the body. You see, hey, he's a soul. She's a soul. And the relationship can go so deep on the spiritual platform. Materially, what can you do together? You drink a little bit, a little sex, you know, go to a movie. You know. What do we do today? Well, same thing we did yesterday. You know. We're all looking. What can we... Here, you can go very deep with your friends, with your lovers, with your countrymen. It's amazing how deep you can go. It's vidya vinaya something. A truly learned person, he sees with equal vision. A learned and gentle Brahman, an elephant, a cow, a dog, and a dog eater. He doesn't see the body. He sees the soul in that dog is equal to me. He's my brother. He's my sister. The spiritual person, like St. Francis of Assisi, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic, so he was like my hero, because I always wanted to be vegetarian. I heard he was a vegetarian. But why is a guy vegetarian? You know why? Because he saw the spiritual nature of all creatures. He knew his spirit, but he looked at it, he said, hey, brother bird, hey, sister bee, hey, cousin fox, hey, nephew frog. So the other priest, he's lost it. This guy's gone, he's wacko. He's gone over the top, Francis. They kicked him out of the church. I was always angry. I'd go to the priest, why did you kick Francis out? It wasn't me, it was like hundreds of years ago. No, he's my buddy, you know. I like the way you think, you kicked him out, I'm not going to come to church anymore. No, please come. He went and started his own church. He wasn't, you know, like all the rules and regulations, you know how religion can be sometimes. So yeah, I don't want to be part of this. If this is what religion is, I don't want anything to do with it. He started his own church. There's the movie you saw in the snow, his blistered, bloody feet, and picking up, you know, I was crying in the movie, you know, putting the blocks there. And then he taught, he taught that concept, and so many people came to him because he was pure of heart. The real leader has to be pure in heart. Not wanting to exploit the others, even as a spiritualist. And then later on, the church realized, oh, wait a minute, we've got a jewel here. We have St. Francis. And therefore, that's why he was vegetarian. Not because, again, healthy body, good sex. He was a vegetarian because he didn't want to hurt any brother or sister. His love for all creatures was like your love for your family. How much do you love your mom or dad? I mean, I was born in a very good home. I really love my mom and dad, and my brother and my sister. But when you become a self-realized soul, you love everybody as much as you love your mom and dad. That's divine love. And therefore, you don't want to harm. You would never eat any meat or fish or eggs because you see that violence. And you know, if you do it, comes right back in your face. What goes around comes around. So if you eat meat to maintain your body, of course, probably you're all vegetarian, but you can use this argument if you need. Karma means that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you do good, good comes back. If you do bad, like I was recently in Alice Springs, Australia, and I was called to a program like this of Aborigines. Can you imagine? Introducing this Vedic culture to Aborigines. You know, they're beautiful people, but the Australian government has suppressed them. They don't have proper education. They don't have proper medical facilities. Now it's changing a little bit. They're simple, like nomads, some of them in the desert. But you know what? They love the program. Because they're close to nature, they're close to God. So everything I'm talking about, yeah, we already know that. I'm the big Maharaj coming to teach, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, geez, I feel like a little ant. And they knew about the law of karma. He said, I will show you law of karma. one village chief said. He took the boomerang. He said, "You try it." Shh. Hey, where did it go? Oh. He said, "That's karma. What you do comes back to you." So I said to them, "That's why you guys have to start becoming vegetarian. You're not vegetarian yet." They said, "Yes." So I thought, well, I did something here. So it's good to go within. It's not just, you know, a small percentage of society is interested in yoga and meditation. Hey, this is a universal culture which can actually help the whole wide world. And to help us bring forth that divine nature, which is good for us and good for the whole world and good for our brothers and sisters, the animals. This is a very nice way to do it, through mantra meditation, chanting Hare Krishna. It's like, you know, the soul is sleeping in ignorance. All these things are help. This philosophy wakes us up. But to realize our nature, the divine nature of others, ultimately to realize the divine nature of the Supreme as a person, really. The divine is actually a person with whom we have a very intimate, loving relationship with. In Sanskrit, they call him Krishna, the Supreme. He's not an old man with a gray beard, you know, holding up the earth. Ah! No. He's described as Nayovanamcha, ever youthful. The absolute truth, or God, whatever you want to call it. He's very beautiful. He's very charming. Youthful. He's like, it's a form of a young boy, and he plays a flute. He has a peacock feather. He's dressed in a yellow dhoti, and he sports with his friends eternally in the spiritual sky. And this is the real goal of yoga, to liberate ourselves from the repetition of birth and death and join that divine person in the spiritual world from whence we came in those very sweet, beautiful pastimes in the spiritual sky. So to wake that up, you need the kundalini, you need the shakti, you need the force to wake up that sleeping soul. Yeah, one boy told me, "Well, I'm not going to follow all those rules and regulations like you guys. I'm just going to get a big alarm clock." Yeah, this is true. You get a big alarm, I'm just going to put it there. No. Material will not wake up the spiritual. It takes spiritual to wake up the spiritual. You need some divine sound which penetrates through all this ignorance. I'm the body. Life's meant for enjoyment. There's no... anything spiritual, it's all, like the scientists say, it's all just mechanics in this universe, and there's no soul, there's no God. You need something powerful. So mantra, spiritual sound, is very powerful, especially this Maha Mantra. Even without this talk, you can understand all these things by chanting this mantra. I mean, I'm talking to you just to share some of my realizations from being a bhakti yogi for almost 40 years. But even if you're not very philosophically inclined, and even if you can't go to the Himalayas and sit on the ice floes, who can do it anyway? But if you just chant this mantra, it's like medicine. If you may be sick and you take the medicine, you don't know how it's working. You don't know how it's going through the body and fighting the virus, but the doctor says it'll work. Okay, doc, you take it, and you start feeling better. So the doctors of the soul, the yogis, the self-realized soul, they say this medicine will help you become self-realized. And it's pleasant medicine. You know, like, usually medicine's bitter. One of my friends I saw yesterday, he got an injection and he had abscess here, and my disciple, Brajavilas, he cut into his neck, Bhakti Marg Swami, he had this abscess. The whole thing was very painful and ugly. But this medicine, by grace of Supreme, is sweet. Madhur, madhur, madhur bhaji. So the very process of becoming liberated is very joyful. Not just when you get there, "Oh, wow, now everything's okay." No, the means to getting self-realized, it's so nectarian that you can't stop. And I have been chanting this mantra for like almost 40 years. And whatever I know, whatever I've realized, I'm not very philosophical. You can see I've got a tape ministry. You listen to the lectures. That's actually wonderful. What I've really learned is, as a result of this awakening of the spirit by mantra meditation. So we'd like to encourage you all. You've come here today, you're spiritual seekers, you want to get into yoga. enjoy all the benefits of yoga, but know the goal is to go within and realize your deeper spiritual self, and you can do it in a very joyful way, just by chanting. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. You know, some chanting, some philosophy. Another part of the bhakti yoga process is eating. In the hatha yogis in the Himalayas, they eat leaves, bark. That's why he became a Hare Krishna, because, you know, leaves are not tough. You know. The brown one or the green one? I'll take the green one. Green leaf. No, you can also, in other words, the sense, we're talking about the sense of becoming entangled, but the same thing that caused the disease can cure a disease. Like if, in India, if you drink too much milk in the hot season, you get the runs. To cure it, you drink yogurt. Yogurt cools the body. The same substance, transform, cures you. So the senses engaged in this material world, they contaminate. But if you use the same senses in a spiritual way, if you use the eyes to see the holy places, the ear to hear divine sounds, the nose to smell nice incense, the tongue to glorify the Supreme, even the genital can be used to conceive spiritually advanced children. It's such a pleasure to bring up. So all the senses in bhakti yoga can be engaged, not just meditation, but active life in Krishna consciousness. This is our kind of our way of life. So therefore, food is an essential part of our process. And we take nice vegetarian food, we offer it to the Supreme, we offer it to Krishna, and then we eat it. And it's not spirit, it's not material. You're going to taste a little bit later some nice food. Don't think it's material. You take a cold piece of steel, you put it in the fire, take it out, it's just like fire. You take food, you offer it to the Supreme, it comes out divine. You eat it, then you make your way back. So bhakti yoga, he sings, he dances, he philosophizes. With a little tired at the end, he relishes some nice vegetarian food. This is our process for sharing, which all of you can add, of course, to your present technique.